Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. Stephen Starr is an associate member of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, a senior scientist with Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the director of the Clinical Laboratory Science Program at the University of Missouri. His writings have been published by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and by many reputable websites about nuclear weapons proliferation and environmental responsibility. He's worked with the governments of Switzerland, Chile, New Zealand and Sweden in support of their efforts at the United Nations to eliminate thousands of high-alert, launch-ready nuclear weapons. He's made presentations to the ministry officials, parliamentarians, universities, citizens and students from around the world, and specialises in making scientific, technical information understandable to all audiences. Today, Stephen joins us on the line from Missouri. Good afternoon, Stephen.
Hi, Helen.
How are you?
Fine, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you too. Now, we've got a very important program today. We're going to talk about things that the average person, I don't think, really understands. I think it's probably... Well, first of all, I'd like to ask you, Stephen, how did you get involved in this issue of nuclear weapons in the first place?
Well, I grew up, I was a boy in the 1950s, and I have a distinct memory of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And back then, it seemed like people were here in the United States were much more aware of the threat of nuclear war. It was a topic that was often discussed during presidential elections. And I actually went into nuclear engineering when I was a freshman in college. However, at that time they were selling nuclear power as it was going to provide electricity that was going to be too cheap to meter. And it sounded good to me as a boy, but when I got into college, I realized that this is not something that was friendly to living things. When you started studying the effects of radiation and it was glossed over by the engineering department. And at the same time, there weren't any jobs really. They'd stopped making nuclear power plants in the United States, and most of the jobs really were defense-related. So I had a change of heart and went into the biological sciences, but that was where I first became, that's where my background that got me interested in the subject.
And how old were you when the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred, Stephen Starr?
I was about 10 years old. Mm. You know, I'm working with a retired Russian colonel right now who actually was operating a battery of missiles outside of Moscow at that time, some of them which were probably aimed at me. And Colonel Yurinich, you introduced me to him in one of your conferences, actually. But we both are now on the same side trying to eliminate nuclear weapons.
Yes, he's a lovely fellow indeed. Did he talk to you about the Cuban Missile Crisis and how he felt at the time?
You know, I actually am trying to get him to write a paper about this because he told me that if the weapons were as they are now, right now we have 2,000 warheads that the U.S. and Russia still maintain on quick launch high alert status, which can be launched in 30 seconds to 3 minutes. Colonel Yurinich told me if the missiles were in the same status then as they are now, we wouldn't have survived the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, really?
Yes.
God Almighty. Well, I got to know Robert McNamara towards the end of his life, and I remember him saying to me, Helen, you don't know how close we came. And I think it was, you know, minutes in the Oval Office before Jack Kennedy vetoed the whole thing. Anyway, so, and what was the attitude of the nuclear engineers with whom you trained at university at that time, Stephen?
Well, nuclear engineering, I found that in general the engineering sciences that need have a desperate lack for more courses in biology and environmental environmental science, just because we continue to train people that have no really comprehension of what the byproducts of their work can produce. I honestly think that we should have a global treaty to prevent the production of any sort of environmental toxin that is highly poisonous and lasts for, you know, hundreds or thousands of years. And like plutonium comes to mind immediately, but you know what I'm talking about. There's really very little. There's a distinct effort to try to, I guess I would say brainwash. It's a strong word, but there's other words that are a little bit nicer to say. But people are not supposed to think about the ramifications of their work when it comes to making nuclear weapons or nuclear waste.
That's amazing. I would use the direct word brainwashing. I think it's important to speak the stark truth, because what they're doing is much darker almost than the truth can be believed. And I think in order to break through people's psychic numbing, they just have to hear the stark truth. So I'd like you now, Stephen Starr, to talk about the main issue at hand. Exactly how many hydrogen bombs are on what we call hair trigger alert in America and in Russia, and what does that actually mean to the world?
Well, right now, the United States and Russia have something like 900 missiles, a total of 900 missiles, with about at least 2,000 strategic nuclear warheads that they can launch in 30 seconds to 3 minutes' time.
Come night, there are only 900 missiles, but 2,000 strategic warheads. You'd better describe how you can put lots of hydrogen bombs on one missile, and then how these bombs are directed in space to certain targets.
Yes, well, back in the 1970s and 80s, they developed this thing called multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles, which allowed you to put more than one warhead on a missile. You can put 8 to 10 warheads on the missiles. The Russian SS-18s carry 10 strategic warheads. They each have an average explosive power of 750,000 tons of TNT.
That's nearly a million tons of TNT. So
yes,
there are 10?
That compares to the 15,000 tons of TNT from the bombs that were detonated in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
So that means 10 hydrogen bombs, almost equivalent to a million tons of TNT each, on each of their missiles.
Yes, SS-18s carry about 10. The SS-19s carry 6. The U.S. ICBMs often carry 3. The submarine-launched ballistic missiles that we have can carry up to 8. The treaties that we have supposedly have reduced the numbers of the warheads carried by the missiles now on some of these. They call them weapons platforms. They have lots of nice names to describe the missiles. Launch vehicles and delivery vehicles. It sounds like something you'd deliver lunch with. But
yeah, or
the
milk.
Language is used in all ways to disguise the absolute danger that these weapons create. You know, if I could, maybe I should describe what the effect of one weapon would be. And then the recent studies that show that even less than 1% of these weapons would cause deadly climate change.
Okay, well, wait a minute. I think it's imperative that people listening to this, certainly in the West, understand that what we really need to know about is the Russian hydrogen bombs, because we're targeted with them. And most towns and cities in America, Canada, Australia, Europe, England are targeted with these God almighty, huge weapons, and we tend only to talk about American weapons, but they're targeted on Russia and China. What we need to do is be a little bit more egocentric, I think, and think about actually what's targeted on us per se. So, okay, do a description of one of these vast hydrogen bombs exploding, I guess, on Washington, D.C., Stephen Starr. And then extrapolate from there to the whole scenario.
Well, an average Russian 550 kiloton warhead would set something like 200 to 300 square kilometers on fire instantly when it would be detonated over an urban area.
Well, what would that involve? What would that involve in D.C.? What actually would be totally burnt?
Well, the entire area of Washington, D.C. would be totally burnt. There would be nothing left, although actually there's probably 20 or 30 of these weapons targeted on Washington, D.C., because they focus on blast effects rather than thermal or fire
effects.
Why
would they target 20 or 30 hydrogen bombs on Washington, D.C.? Is it old-fashioned thinking, like one bomb goes to the railway station, one bomb goes to the Pentagon, one to the White House, not even understanding that they all coalesce in one God almighty, huge, massive, catastrophic holocaust?
Well, I think that when you said old-fashioned thinking, that's kind of the heart of the issue. We're still debating these weapons with a 20th century World War II mindset, as if one side had more bombs than the other, we would somehow be ahead. But what was lost in the process of this was really an understanding, at least a gut understanding, a common sense understanding of what these weapons do. The United States actually doesn't even include thermal effects in its war planning manuals, and they only look at blast effects because they consider them more predictable. But the fire from a large strategic weapon, when a bomb explodes, it creates the temperatures hotter than the center of the sun, whether it's a Hiroshima-sized weapon or a huge strategic weapon, a hydrogen bomb.
Why is it hotter than the center of the sun? I thought it was the same process, fusion.
Well, let's just say it's about the same. I don't know if anybody's ever really... They have measured these things. They've done a lot of tests. And according to the authoritative book by Dolan and Gladstone, Effects of Nuclear Weapons, that was published by the U.S. Department of Defense, that it creates temperatures hotter than the center of the sun. The fireball that's created has temperatures similar to the surface of the sun. And so anything that's even remotely near this is actually vaporized.
Well, what temperatures are they? What is the temperature inside the center of the sun?
Oh, it's hundreds of millions of degrees Fahrenheit.
Hundreds of millions of degrees Fahrenheit.
Yes. So when a bomb explodes, it's not really a bomb that we think of. It's more like a piece of the sun being ignited close to the surface of the Earth.
Right.
And in that second, it creates such enormous temperatures that anything that's exposed to it, even from many kilometers away, many miles away, will catch on fire and be burned, and that's how these huge firestorms.
Yeah. Well, what would happen, for instance, to the Congress? That's a huge sort of marble edifice. Would that vaporize, or what actually would happen to that?
Well, if the fireball vaporizes anything it comes in contact with, so most of these weapons are if they target them to maximize blast, they usually put the fireball about 1,500. Feet above ground, maybe 1,000 meters. It depends, but they try to create a double blast wave with the effect. So, but if it comes down and it touches the surface, anything that touches where the fireball touches the earth, it vaporizes it and just turns all millions of tons of the earth's surface into fallout.
So basically, the Congress per se, that building, would be vaporized.
If it was a little farther away, it could be melted, it could be blasted apart. But the thing about these firestorms are that anything that's inside the perimeter of the firestorm will not survive, because once these fires, what the bomb does, it ignites fires over hundreds of square miles, and they all coalesce into a single gigantic fire. And what happens is then the wind blows towards the center of that fire. It actually creates hurricane-force winds in about 10 or 15 minutes that all blow towards the center of the fire, and they make the flames go horizontal at ground level.
Yeah.
And so air temperatures are rapidly above the boiling point of water. So nothing survives in that area. In fact, and everything that's remotely flammable will burn, including, asphalt roads, telephone poles. And it would be too hot to even enter that area in a tracked vehicle like a tank for probably a week or two afterwards.
Hills, bells.
So it's incredible. I mean, it literally is hell on earth when you detonate one of these weapons. What's shocking to think that we have thousands of them ready to be launched, that each president has a military officer that follows them around 24 hours a day with a little briefcase. And this is an automated communication device that allows the president to give the permission order to launch these weapons. And strategic rocket forces, or the command centers for both U.S. and Russia, are there. They always have someone there 24 hours a day waiting at the control panel, ready to facilitate that order. So there's not very much time to think these things through, since it takes 30 minutes for a missile to travel from the U.S. to Russia and Russia to the U.S., or less, depending on what part of the world you're in. That it only allows the president, at the most, about 10 or 12 minutes to make a decision about how to react if their attack is perceived to be underway.
And how do they perceive the attack, per se? How do they know that, that the Russians have launched their missile forces or vice versa?
Well, what happened was, back when they got these weapons first developed, everyone realized that there was absolutely no defense against a hydrogen bomb exploding over you. And these sense of warheads travel at 17,000 miles per hour, it's a little bit difficult to shoot them down. So the military solution has always been to launch your weapons upon warning of attack. So they set up all these early warning systems. First, they were land-based, and then they set up satellites that orbit the Earth. And they're always watching 24 hours a day, although the Russians, in the 1990s, they ran out of money. They also were kind of under the assumption that we were going to get rid of these weapons, but the U.S. didn't seem to have the same idea. But recently, Geoff Forden told me that there's something like 3 out of the 22 satellites that Russia had are still functioning.
3 out of 22 are functioning, so almost
none.
Yeah,
so there are at least 8 to 12 hours a day the Russians are unable to look at American missile fields. They also were unable to look at submarine-launched ballistic missiles, which was caused with their satellites. So in 1995, when Norway launched a weather satellite, they reacted to it as a hostile U.S. attack because the letter from Norway had got lost in the mail, and it was a U.S.-designed missile that appeared on their ground-based radar as a U.S. ICBM, or submarine-launched ballistic missile, coming out of the North Sea. And we almost had a nuclear war then.
Well, we were, seconds from a nuclear war, because Yeltsin, for the very first time, the football or that case,
yeah,
with the
those briefcases that I
opened.
Described were open.
Was the first time ever. Now, so let me be clear. The satellites that are circling the Earth the whole time, or in geosynchronous orbit, pick up the heat and the white light from the hydrogen bombs and missiles hurtling through space, radio that back. Well, the American satellites radio it back to Pine Gap, which is the biggest CIA base in the world in Central Australia, and then that message is sent to the Strategic Air Command in Omaha, Nebraska, or wherever, and then that message is then sent to the president. And the other way they can pick the attack up is by ground-based radars that can see incoming hydrogen bombs and missiles. So the Russians have virtually no satellites, but they have their ground-based radars, which can only pick up the attack as the bombs are almost about to explode overhead. Whereas in America, they've got both ground-based radars and they've also got their satellites, right?
Yeah, I'd say that's a pretty good approximation. But, it is. I would hope at some point your listeners would be asking themselves, why is this still in operation? why do we, have 20 years after the end of the Cold War, why does Russia and the United States still feel the need to keep thousands of warheads?
Well, we'll get on to that in a minute. But tell us, Stephen Starr. Stephen is a senior consulting scientist to Physicians for Social Responsibility and also a biologist. How do false alarms occur, for instance, in the American early warning system? And give us some examples of where the system was set off by various unrelated events which almost caused nuclear wars.
Well, I will have to tell you that in 1985, the U.S. Department of Defense began classifying all this information because they really don't want everyone to know about all their false alarms. But there were some well-documented cases that occurred shortly before then when there was a training tape that was left in the NORAD computers, and the main computer went down and the backup computer that was running this training tape of a massive Russian ICBM attack on the U.S. lit up the screen, and at that point everybody scrambled and the lids rolled back on the silos and the bombers went airborne. The Russians have never talked that much about their false alarms. They're very secretive, but they, and the Soviets too, I should say, but they did announce, Yeltsin did discuss that 1995 incident we mentioned a few minutes ago. But I'd like to also talk about now that there's the thing called cyber warfare that's been very much being developed. There's more than 20 nations that have cyber warfare capabilities, and including North Korea.
And what's that?
They have
that?
These attack. Yeah, well, the cyber warfare are computer programs that are designed to disable and confuse your enemy's computer systems, and specifically, they're designed to disable and confuse nuclear command and control systems. Now, this is not really something I see as desirable, particularly if you get into a situation where you're already, some say there's some crisis that arises, you know, that maybe the Russians get mad at Georgia and invade again, and NATO troops are there, and somebody starts shooting at each other. Well, that's not a good time when everybody goes to higher alert levels to suddenly have your command and control system disabled. Even worse, if you could create the illusion of a false attack, which is possible, you could probably put a... Now, the computer systems supposedly are not, you know, they're not hooked up to the Internet that the Department of Defense uses, but who knows? I mean, there's so many computers and there's so many people. These are elaborate systems that tie together not only the missiles. The missiles are tied to the early warning systems that are tied to the command and control that link to the president, and they all link together. There's, you know, thousands of computers, and these are very complex systems. So who's to say how perfect they are from interference or hackers?
Could the hackers, be they North Koreans or Chinese or whoever, hack into the Pentagon early warning system?
Well, they said a lot of things couldn't happen, like Chernobyl and the Challenger and the, you know, the deep water drilling in the Gulf, the safe thing as far as I know. But I don't think the problem is with nuclear war. All it takes is one catastrophic failure, and if the weapons start going, then basically it will be a mass extinction event that can eliminate not only human life, but most complex forms of life on Earth if all these weapons start going off.
Well, weren't the early warning systems in America, they've been set off on numerous occasions by a rising moon or a flock of geese, where the satellites interpret those white flashes of light as missiles and hydrogen bombs hurtling through space, right?
Well, let's just say all those things have happened in the past. But let's just say that the military has absolutely perfected the system now, and they don't have any of these little glitches like that occur. But suppose that somebody coerces one of the launch officers, or maybe they capture their family and they blackmail them, or maybe there's a plant, and somebody gets into the system and puts a virus in the system that suddenly, you know, it lays dormant and then suddenly creates this illusion of a massive missile attack on the U.S. The problem is sometimes if you're so sure of your systems that they're perfect, then if you have overlapping errors that reinforce each other, then that makes you more vulnerable to, that's part of the reason, well, that is one of the main reasons why I've been working at the UN since 2007 with John Hollam there from Australia, a good friend of mine, and we've been working with Switzerland, Sweden, New Zealand, Chile, Nigeria, and Malaysia to a limit, you know, they've been putting forth a resolution every year to eliminate high alert, quick launch weapon systems. And, because everybody sees these as really the most dangerous aspect of the existing nuclear arsenals, because they don't allow any time. If you can launch these incredible weapons in just a matter of seconds, and you're always ready to launch them, then it's just it's the ultimate accident waiting to happen.
As you talk, Stephen Starr, I actually don't quite understand how we're still here. I mean, no, truly.
Well, we're lucky, really. I mean, it is a miracle that we've survived all these years. The sad thing is so many people see that as proof that the system is working and that it's safe. You know, it's actually politically incorrect, really, to discuss the dangers of American nuclear weapons here in the United States.
Really?
Because Well, yeah. I mean, I think the same thing holds true in a lot of the nuclear weapon states always view their own weapons as being safe. It's always somebody else's weapons that are dangerous. And, you know, our weapons here are here to keep the peace. You know, you were with me here in Kansas City just a couple of weeks ago to try to speak out against a nuclear weapons plant they're going to be build here like 125 miles away from where I live. But people don't see this as an evil thing. They see this is they call it nuclear deterrence. It deters war and keeps us safe from war. And yet they don't talk about nuclear weapons anymore. They just talk about deterrence. It's a way to frame the subject. But I honestly can't see how nuclear weapons can provide national security when a single failure of deterrence can essentially kill everybody on the planet.
Okay. Let's go into an actual nuclear war. And I want you to describe the targeting system on Moscow and Washington and New York City and every small town in America with a population, I think, greater than 100,000, and in Europe and in Britain and in China and in Russia and in Canada and Australia and Japan. I want you to describe such an event, Stephen Starr.
I'm going to really cheer up your listeners with this.
Well, I need to know. I mean, it's like me as a doctor telling a patient, a couple of parents,
right,
that their child has leukemia or cystic fibrosis. Right. You can't sugarcoat it. You can be gentle,
that's right,
with empathy, but they have to know the truth. And this is our world and our responsibility. And if we want our children and babies to survive, we have to know what the reality is so that we can stop this madness.
That's right.
Okay.
Well, while we go to our jobs every day and take care of our kids and try to figure out how to make our mortgage payments, somewhere in the dark bowels of the earth and submarines underneath the oceans, there's always thousands of nuclear weapons that are sitting on top of these missiles that are very carefully maintained. We spend $80 billion a year, every year in the United States, to make sure these weapons are working, that are ready to launch a nuclear war. And if such a war ever took place, the U.S. and Russia each have many thousands of operational weapons. And you can give all these numbers, but if you just think in terms of the total explosive power, the weapons that we have that are called operational and deployed that are ready to use have about 800 times the explosive power of all the bombs that were detonated and exploded during the entire course of World War II. And within an hour, we can unleash this power. And so, you know, if you know that each strategic weapon can set something between 60 to 300 square kilometers on fire instantly when it's detonated, you can imagine if hundreds or thousands of these are suddenly detonated over all these cities. And, you know, the military will tell you, well, we don't target cities, but they do target military targets, and quite a few targets that happen to be political and military industrial targets are next to cities. So you figure the U.S. and Russia each have something like a couple hundred cities with populations of greater than 100,000 people. Well, if we have 2,000 weapons we can launch in 3 minutes, there's a pretty good chance that most of those cities are going to be hit. And if you're in a strategic area, whether, you know, if you're in Australia next to a big listening post, or if you're in some big, large cities in Europe where your political leaders reside, or where your own country's nuclear weapons are,
target. Of course, they target political leaders because they're military targets. So, of course, all the major cities are targeted. It's where leaders live. Yep.
So, you know, instantly, within 15 minutes, every major city in the world would probably go up in a nuclear firestorm with hundreds of thousands of square miles on fire. And then, you know, within a matter of a day or two, with the studies that I've been trying to, if you go to my website, I'll do a little advertising here. It's nuclearddarkness.org.com. But you can see the visualization of this. But I focus on what the climatic consequences of nuclear war, the environmental consequences would be if all these bombs, even 100 bombs, go off, but starting with 100 up to thousands, the immense firestorms produce millions of tons of smoke, if you can believe that. Can you imagine a million tons of smoke? But when you can burn everything imaginable in thousands of square miles and you have this happen over and over again, within a couple of days, the Earth will be surrounded by a layer of smoke. The smoke rises above cloud level and goes into the stratosphere where it can't be rained out. And because it's very black smoke, it's heated up by the sun, and it actually is kind of like a solar collector. It's a self-lofting effect. The smoke will stay in the stratosphere for 10 years. And this is what the new studies in 2006 discovered, that they showed that the original studies on nuclear winter actually underestimated the effects, the environmental consequences of nuclear war. And so if you start out with, and let's just, you know, you've asked about a massive nuclear exchange between U.S. and Russia. Well, first, let's just imagine India and Pakistan. You know, right now they have close to 200 weapons over there between them. If about 100 of those were detonated in the cities of India and Pakistan, it would produce about 5 million tons of smoke that would block 10% of the light from reaching the surface of the Earth. So, and this would happen in a matter of about days.
Days.
Then, yeah. And that smoke will stay there for 10 years. And it will produce ice age temperatures on Earth. It would produce the coldest temperatures experienced in the last 1,000 years. Would be too cold to grow wheat or grain in Canada for several years, at least. What that would mean would be that most of the grain-exporting nations would stop exporting grain because they would be quickly realized that they're going to have a hard time feeding their own countries. So every nation that's dependent on grain imports would be just in terrible shape. And the people that are already hungry in the world, which are like 800 million to a billion, would probably starve to death in a matter of a year or two, just with, you know, a 10% reduction in their caloric intake. They'd be at risk for starvation, but there would be no grain exports for many years. Now, that's a war with 100 Hiroshima-sized weapons.
Well, let me ask you, do you think that the military and political leaders in Pakistan and India understand what you just said, Stephen Starr?
You know, it's not clear to me that any political leaders understand about the environmental consequences of nuclear war.
What about Obama?
You know, I don't know. I was at the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference.
Where was it?
I was with David Krieger, and I was able to ask. There was a joint presentation with the Russian ambassador and the U.S. Negotiator, Assistant Secretary of State Rose Gottmuller, who. We were able to put questions to them, and I asked the U.S. representative, "Are you familiar with the recent studies that show that less than 1% of the deployed and operational Russian and U.S. nuclear arsenals detonated in conflict could cause grave changes in climate, and if the U.S. and Russian weapons on high alert were detonated, it would threaten all human life?" And she said, "Well, the Russian ambassador said, no, I'm not familiar with that. And the American ambassador's American representative said, well, I'm not familiar with any recent studies." And these are the people that are negotiating the arms reduction treaties. They don't even know the science.
But didn't you jump up and down and say, well, you bloody well should know? I would have.
Well, I did the best that I could. At least I got the question out there. David Krieger asked Ellen Tauscher. It was a takeoff. I've suggested that we need an environmental impact statement on the consequences of the use of the American nuclear arsenal in conflict. No nuclear weapon state has ever done an evaluation
Truly?
Of the environmental consequences
that
of a nuclear
amazing.
War.
That is amazing. That's
never
amazing.
And Ellen, and so David Krieger said, "Well, Ms. Tauscher, wouldn't you think it would be a good way to support President Obama's vision of a world without nuclear weapons to do an environmental impact statement on the consequences of the use of the U.S. nuclear arsenal?" And she curtly replied, "No, we don't need to do that."
Now, who is Ellen Tauscher? What's her position?
Well, she's I believe she's another Assistant Secretary of State. I'm a little weak on that. I hope I'm not wrong, but she's one of the people that's basically in charge of, I think, nonproliferation and those sorts of things in the U.S. Department of State.
Well, I know Ellen Tauscher. She, I think, got turned on by me years ago, and she was in the Congress, and I went to see her recently.
You need to call her back. Yeah, she was from California.
I went to see her recently. She gave me a huge hug and said, "Anything I can do,
really?
Dr. Caldicott, let me know." But that's
okay.
So...
awesome. That's a good place to start.
Why don't you try and describe this really strange, aberrant thinking? You talked about, you know, the words are used over and over again, like safe, reliable, modernization,
well, yes,
just the way you would sell soap or beer. Describe this crazy sort of thought process and euphemistic thinking, Stephen Starr, about nuclear weapons.
We really are still locked in a World War II mindset here. The Republicans are attacking Obama for, you know, making the world a very dangerous place because he's, you know, we're eliminating all these nuclear weapons that we desperately need to have, and the Russians have more tactical weapons than we do, and we're locked into a position of permanent inferiority.
What is a tactical weapon and what is a strategic weapon? You need to define these terms.
I'm sorry. A tactical weapon, that's an old term, really, but now they say strategic and non-strategic. The only real difference is the distance they can travel, but traditionally, a strategic weapon is a hydrogen bomb, a thermal nuclear weapon. The smallest strategic nuclear weapon has an explosive power of 100,000 tons of TNT as compared to 15,000 tons of TNT from a Hiroshima weapon. And the largest conventional weapon, which is chemical explosive, high explosive, like you could think of TNT, the largest one in the U.S. U.S. conventional arsenal in 2009 had an explosive power of 11 tons of TNT. So you compare 11 tons of TNT for the largest conventional bomb, 15,000 tons of TNT for Hiroshima weapons are the size of the weapons that India and Pakistan are building right now, and then 100,000 to 500,000 to a million tons of TNT for the strategic weapons that the U.S. and Russia and the other nuclear weapons
that they have on their intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Yes, and the submarine launch missiles. The U.S. always has four Trident subs at what they call hard alert status, where they're in position to fire, and another six to eight that are always rotating in and out.
Okay,
each one of these subs carries 24 missiles and can launch up to 200 warheads.
Each of these submarines?
Yeah.
And do the Russians have any nuclear submarines now?
They do, but they don't run. They don't have nearly the same capacity that the U.S. does. They don't have access to cold water ports in the same way the U.S. does. And they're working on new subs, but their sub fleet's much smaller than the U.S. And they for the last number of years, they probably only run two or three, four patrols a year, whereas the U.S. is constantly on patrol. So that's another very lopsided. The Russians are very threatened by this. You know, if you look at, believe me, I'm not highly sympathetic to the Russians because I think they're just as guilty as the Americans in a lot of things with nuclear. But from their standpoint, the Americans have built military bases that have surrounded Russia. We've
and China.
Taken our NATO and we expanded it up practically to the borders of Russia. We've in some ways we have because the Russians have an enclave by Poland called Kaliningrad, and next to that is Poland, and we have displaced batteries of Patriot missiles there. The Russians see all this as very threatening. The missile defense systems that we're going to put in Poland and Czechoslovakia could easily target all the Russian ICBMs east of the Ural Mountains and or west. But most of their land-based nuclear forces were at risk from this. And
well, why on earth is the Pentagon and the political powers that be in the United States doing this? It's so provocative. What on earth do they think they're up to?
I don't know. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me. The stuff with NATO scares me the most, really, because, you know, when there was that conflict there in Georgia not that long ago, the U.S. actually had our Marines. We were training the Georgian Army. We supplied them. We had a major training exercise with the Georgian Army 3 weeks before the Georgians. It was the Georgians that initiated the attack on the enclave overnight. But the Russians saw it coming, so they'd built up their forces in the border, and they retaliated, and they went into the country. Maybe they overdid it. I don't know. But, you know, if the same thing happened, say, on the Canadian or the Mexican border of the United States, I wonder how we would react. But, you know, then NATO sailed their fleet into the Black Sea, right, and to deliver humanitarian aid to Georgia. It was in close proximity to the Russian fleet. The Russians were publishing stories about how they could blow the NATO fleet out of the water if they needed to, and those are the kind of, that was honestly, I haven't been that worried about foreign affairs for a long time. That was right before the last election, if you recall. But I still don't see any profound change in what's going on with NATO with the Obama administration. They seem to turn a blind eye to It's like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing.
Yeah. How would you psychoanalyze these characters who have these death-inducing policies, Stephen Starr?
Well, Helen, you're probably better at that than I am, but I honestly, the true believers that I've run up against, that I've had a few chances to really debate, they will not, like I did a presentation of all the environmental consequences of nuclear war with the, I have animated smoke graphics, like I said, you could see in my website, nuclearddarkness.org. It shows, you know, what would happen if there's a nuclear war, if the smoke engulfing the earth and ice age temperatures. These are horrible things, but these are made with predictions that use NASA computer models, state of the art. I mean, the best science that the U.S. has right now, these are peer-reviewed studies. And when I had this debate with, I'm not really supposed to name the person, but he was the former representative from the Bush administration.
Go on, name him.
Well, it was Christopher Ford.
Okay.
And he wouldn't address any of my arguments. He would not address a single scientific argument I made. He just said, oh, you're just trying to scare people. I had some pictures of hydrogen bombs, as compared to atomic bombs, because if you put a Hiroshima weapon next to a 15 megaton weapon, which is 1,000 times bigger, well, the mushroom cloud's 1,000 times bigger. It's incredible. And I think that must have upset him a little bit. But the true believers like Ford will not go beyond the moment of failure. They will not think about the consequences of nuclear war because they believe as long as all these chess pieces of deterrence are kept in place and we have our missile defense and we modernize our weapons, that there won't be a war. So they won't go there. They won't discuss what happens if something goes wrong.
Okay, so Stephen Starr, compare what you've just said with the Gulf oil catastrophe that's happening as we speak.
Well, that was a... And they decided to drill an exploratory well, a mile beneath the ocean, and then went another 30,000 feet deep. It's something never been tried before. And suddenly, they were cheaping out too. They did it on the cheap there because they were in a hurry to save money. And suddenly, we now have something like 5 million gallons of oil coming out into the Gulf Ocean every day. It's going to kill the Gulf at this rate. I just heard today that a third of the Gulf is now off limits to fishing.
Oh,
and
dear.
It's unbelievable. 5 million gallons of oil a day have been pouring out into the Gulf for 3 months. And they can't stop it. They don't know how to stop it. But guess what? They never did any studies. They assumed that this could never happen, so never ever imagined what the consequences of it would be. They're still not even evaluating the consequences now, from what I can see, or else if they are, they're hiding it from the people.
And they're trying, I just read yesterday too, that they're trying to save 70,000 turtle eggs along the coast. It just makes your heart bleed.
Well, it's awful, but no matter what they do, and each and every day that goes by, millions and millions of gallons of oil are pouring out at the bottom of the ocean, and they can't get to it. They can't fix it. And the same thing, if you unleash these nuclear arsenals, and they're allowed to be detonated, it will be a mass extinction event similar to when an asteroid hit the Earth 65 million years ago. We know enough about it now. That's when the dinosaurs became extinct. It was 7 or 8 kilometers in diameter. It hit near the Yucatan Peninsula. And it exploded. The debris that it threw up in the atmosphere heated the entire Earth's atmosphere above broiling for 7 or 8 hours. It ignited all the forests on Earth on fire, and they all burned, and it created the same smoke layer that we're talking about that would be created from nuclear war. And 70% of the species on Earth disappeared at that time. And that's what we have sitting on top of these missiles. We have a mass extinction event waiting to happen. Now, I can't understand, what political or national goal can justify this, a war that would, and even the leaders, if they think they've got some sort of super shelter they can hide in somewhere, they got another thing coming because, they come back out on the planet 10 years from now and look around, there's not going to be anything to eat. There aren't going to be many animals left. How are they going to survive? A friend of mine who's an ecologist from New Zealand, he took me to his house and he educated me on these things. And he said, there aren't even any fossil remains for like about 10 million years after some of these mass extinction events. It takes that long for life to develop and plants and things to get built up again.
What puzzles me is this intense discussion about global warming, which is absolutely appropriate, but at the same time, the intense negation or lack of contemplation of a nuclear winter, which is the opposite of global warming. There's a disconnect. It's almost psychotic thinking, a split between reality and perception of reality. And I suppose I would ask you, Stephen Starr, because this has concerned me for 40 years, how do we wake up these these political thinkers and crazy military analysts to understand what on earth they think they're doing?
Well, you mentioned the global warming studies, and I'd like to note that the studies that I focus on for the environmental consequences of nuclear war use the same computer models. They were the Goddard Institute of Space Studies computer models that were used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to model global warming, only they're modeling global cooling from the smoke. But, you know, how do we get this... How do we get this information? Honestly, the question you asked earlier, does Obama know about this? Well, he needs to know about it. I think, you know, my thought is that if this is the scientific information we have now is good enough to show that nuclear war is suicide, that even a first strike, you know, that would win, you know, you can win a nuclear war, destroy all the enemy's nuclear weapons with a first strike, and then you have your ballistic missile defense system as a mop-up system to destroy the last, you know, three or four missiles that aren't taken out by your surprise attack. But the effects of the environmental effects of that surprise attack actually will kill all the people in your own country, along with most of the rest of the people in the world. There is no way to win a nuclear war. And we've got to get this message. You know, as long as we have people like Senator Kyle telling us how, you know, unsafe we are because the Russians have more tactical nuclear weapons than we do, and that we need to spend billions and billions of dollars, you know, rebuilding our entire nuclear weapons complex here in the U.S. in order to be safe. These people just have no comprehension of any of the science, either that or else they're unwilling to listen to it. But I don't think we should, you know, they shouldn't be allowed to be in the positions they're in if they are made aware of it and they will not listen to it. But I do think that if someone like Obama can be educated, you know, given this information, it would be a great tool to talk about a world without nuclear weapons.
Well, I think you and I, Stephen, should go and have half an hour to an hour with President Obama in the Oval Office.
I'd be glad to go.
Alone. So if anyone who's listening to this program has a direct connection to the Obamas or the administration, can you please try and arrange a conference with Stephen Starr and me with Obama in the Oval Office? I would be prepared to pay for my own return plane fare from Sydney, Australia to Washington, D.C. to do that, because we do have a highly intelligent, wise man in the White House for the first time for a long, long time, who is deeply aware, I think, of the dangers of nuclear war. But the people who are running him and the Pentagon and the Oval Office, they have more power than he does at the moment, and we need to talk to him directly. So if anyone can help, please do. And I have a new, this is my little advertisement, Stephen Starr, a new website or a new foundation called the Helen Caldicott Foundation for a Nuclear Free Planet. If you go to my website, nuclearfreeplanet.org, there are huge numbers of articles, including links to Stephen Starr's wonderful, magnificent webpage, so that you can learn a lot more. But the reason I set this new foundation up is that it's very clear to me that people under the age of 35, I'd say, really have no idea of what Stephen Starr and I are talking about, because they don't tend to read newspapers or watch the evening news or read a lot of books. They Twitter and they dig and they Facebook. So my webpage will automatically go to Twitter and to dig and to Facebook, so that these young people may hopefully come across this information and start educating themselves. The other thing is we need a fantastic little YouTube video that'll go viral, like the one that Susan Boyle did when she sang that song. 5 million people, I think, listened within a very short space of time. We need someone like Matt Groening, who does The Simpsons, to do a really sexy, funny, satirical take on this whole absurd situation that Stephen has been describing, so that the younger people know what is the reality of their planet at the moment and work out how to stop it. Now, Stephen, would you like to comment on that?
Well, I will say that I've been asked a number of times, why are nuclear weapons more important than anything else? You know, I had some really smart students ask me that up in Halifax when we were there a couple of years ago. And I said, well, this is nuclear war is the one thing that can almost instantly destroy the human race. I mean, there's many threats that are out there, but this is the one thing it's a man-made thing, too. And in some ways, it's easier to address, you know, we don't have to change our way of living to get rid of nuclear weapons. We just have to have a political decision to do that. And so for those people, I agree. There's most of the people I've met in the last several years when I've traveled around the United States, their mouths fall open. They just can't believe it when I start telling them these things about what one weapon will do and that we have thousands of weapons that are ready to launch. They just don't know they exist, and they're shocked. But I think the only way to really do anything about this is to act together. We can't, you know, and so I commend you for your foundation and for the work you're doing. I think we all have to get together on this and regard it as a true threat to our existence. It's like a dragon in the basement.
Yeah.
You can wake up at any moment.
I wonder if the people's fascinations with dragons in basements and vampires and the like is a sort of displacement activity. They know things are very dangerous and scary, so they cope with something that they intellectually and psychologically can stand rather than looking at the true reality. But the truth is, you know, Stephen, in the 80s, we led the movement against nuclear weapons by describing the medical implications, as you've just been doing and I did and 23,000 other doctors. So it is possible actually to mobilize a huge country to be totally opposed to nuclear weapons and nuclear war. And I think the problem was that when the Cold War ended, as it should have and was excellent that it did, people thought, thank God that's over, now we can relax and enjoy our lives and they'll get rid of the weapons. And they didn't get rid of the weapons. These people are married to their nuclear weapons in some strange psychological, some subliminal midbrain way, right?
I think that's true. It's also money and power. It's just it's a big business, and it's sort of self-perpetuating. It's just like they're trying to rebuild the entire nuclear weapons infrastructure in the United States right now with the idea that the Republicans are holding the START treaty more or less hostage. You know, if they'll pass START through the Senate if we agree to rebuild all of these weapons plants.
I was absolutely
$7 billion plant in New Mexico.
Yeah, you know, John Kyle said to Obama that he won't allow the new treaty that Obama's drawn up with Medvedev, the president of Russia, unless these new nuclear weapons facilities are built and they can build thousands more hydrogen bombs. This is absolute sheer madness. And so you and I were just in Kansas City recently, where they're going to build a huge new nuclear weapons factory to make all the non-nuclear parts for nuclear weapons. The city council is supporting it. They think it's great for business. But as we said at the conference, Stephen, that, you know, I'm sure Hitler talked about creating jobs when he built the gas ovens. Well, this is going to be the global gas oven. And I think that the churches throughout the United States and the synagogues and the Muslim populations and the like need to get onto this ASAP, because it's the ultimate talk of survival and responsibility towards their gods or our God or whatever and towards creation.
Well, the important thing to me is that, you know, if you try to argue against this, I guess maybe I have a scientific bias because I'm trained in science, but I have the very best scientific information that's available right now that shows that just Less than 1% of the weapons that the U.S. and Russia have, if they're detonated in conflict, could kill most of the people on the planet from the environmental consequences of their use. Now, tell me, why do we need to build new plants to make more nuclear weapons when we have close to 9,000 weapons right now here in the U.S., and we have another 15,000 parts of, you know, dismantled plutonium pits sitting around in storage? We're going the wrong way, and as long as we have this World War II mentality about we have to have more bombs than you do to be safe, then we utterly miss the point, and we're like ostriches with our heads in the sand when it comes to the danger.
Well, I would say, and this is a very facetious comment, but you've got to inject a bit of humor into this debate. Maybe all these characters should be given Viagra, and maybe they won't be needing their nuclear weapons quite as much, huh? Now, that's a very
there's whatever works, you know.
I know. Well, Stephen Starr, this has been a fascinating, if scary interview, but an imperative one for everyone to listen to and to understand. If you want to let your friends listen to this, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org. You can download this fascinating interview. Also, know that this program can be played weekly on any community station, NPR station, or Pacific station throughout the country. Indeed, and if you would like to contact your community stations, please feel free to get the program on. I want to thank you, Stephen Starr, from the bottom of my heart. I'm hoping that we can work together in the future. You can do the environmental consequences of nuclear war, and I might talk about the psychological reasons behind this particular gruesome situation. Thank you.
It'll be an honor and a pleasure.
Yeah,
I look forward to that.
Thank you for lending us your time, Stephen.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye. On If You Love This Planet Today, I've been speaking with Stephen Starr, an associate member of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, a senior scientist with Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the director of the Clinical Laboratory Science Program at the University of Missouri. It's also important to note that this program is being played on community stations both in Canada and Australia. And if you would like to get the program played in your local area, please contact your local community station in Canada or Australia, and let's extend and extrapolate the program outwards. Thanks for listening once again. I'm sure you're all in a little state of shock, but we'll be back with you next week, maybe with a more cheery subject. So we'll be with you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.